This ministry is supported by the members and friends of First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. If you would like to support future podcasts, go to www.ucdsm.org to make your contribution.
I have no idea what it means to be a family man. A man of family, I guess I can assume what it means, but really, to be honest, I don't know what it means to be a man, let alone a family man. Now, as I grapple with the expectations of being one, my movies find their way back to a silver screen, resurfacing, forcing the retracing of why I am the way I am and why I can't explain to you what it is to be a family man. Raised by a single mother without a family of her own, I knew no difference. And despite her struggles, I still got cuddles. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were simple. Singing in the car was a staple. Sleep was safe. Childhood secure. Life was good. Still, I couldn't help but feel misplaced. Like a plant placed in an attic and expected to grow just half the water and half the light of every other plant. On Father's Day, I'd celebrate her. Wanting to celebrate something, but without a card, because Hallmark has such little regard for the discarded. When I was 7, she married a man. Someone to look up to and to be like, she said. I was so excited, I unofficially changed my name in school. Because other kids had their dad's names, you know. Known to teachers and friends as a name I'd assume at the prospect of being loved by a family man I called Dad. But even as the bruises have healed on my skin, I can still see them. Like glow-in-the-dark paint, they shine when life is as dark as night. I can still hear the yelling, the smashing of dishes against walls, cracking of doors at the hinges, leaves crunching under my feet as I run to a neighbor's to call the police. I wish that had been just once, but it was 22, once on my birthday. I'm not sure which one. I don't remember asking about my real dad till I was a preteen, when questions went from, Mommy, why do we stop at red lights? To, Mom, is Dad still alive? What was his name again? And how do you spell that? When I met my real dad, I met other kids of his and learned about other ones, too. Learned I wasn't the only one left behind. He has a history of planting his seeds and then walking away. Sitting up at the bar while he worked, I gained the courage to ask if he'd sign this paper. I'd found it on the internet. A paper not releasing him from his parental responsibilities, but releasing me from a legal name I'd never actually been known by. Of course he signed it. He told me, this time will be different, though. We'll go camping. And as I packed my bag with empty promises and false hopes, I knew he wasn't going to show. And when the phone rang, it had a particular sound of deja vu. At least that time he called, I told myself. I changed my last name on the first day of high school. When I got my folder after graduation, it had all of my names, each one crossed out like it had been a mistake. Garrett Rodriguez, scratch that. Garrett Convasor, scratch that. Garrett McGuire. This one will work. For now, see, I took my mother's maiden name, but we haven't spoken in nearly a year, and I can't help but wonder what the hell was the point. You know, what's in a name anyway? Can I just go by Garrett? Memories come and go like dads from my past. Somehow the dark ones outshine the bright ones, and yet I have hope. Hope that memories exist not to punish the punished, but to learn from and to grow from. I can't say I actually believe that until I wrote this. See, even with a wife who holds me up like a steel beam in a strong storm, with two kids whom I love more than anything else, I have bad days. And I have dark days. And when I feel like an inadequate husband, an underprepared parent, an impatient person, I think at least I'm still here. At least I'm still here, holding on to hope that time does heal, that time will bring clarity, that time will teach me to take a breath, to take a pause, to use soft words, to apologize when I've made a mistake and realize I'm a different type of man than the ones I've known, and that I'm going to stay even when it's hard. And I can't help but wonder if without dark memories, I would have known what it is to be a man, if I would have known what it is to be, at least in some part, a family man. Thank you.
If you could erase your bad memories, would you? If you could erase the experiences that can sometimes haunt you, reminding you of mistakes you have made, injuries you have sustained, trauma you have survived, would you? And by erase, I mean wipe clean. I mean remove from your mind forever. Gone. Certainly, we all carry some stories within us that we might prefer not to carry. Stories of times when we have experienced shame or loss or blame. Times when we have not been who we want to be. When we have let down those we love. When we have been let down ourselves or harmed or disgraced. Times when we have been wounded either by our actions or by those of others. When life has dealt us cruel blows. When we've had the wind knocked out of us. Times when we have suffered. If you could erase the memories of these times, would you? A few years ago, researchers at UCLA reported they discovered a means to erase long-term memories. They discovered that by inhibiting a protein enzyme called PKM in snails, they could impact the process by which memories are retained, effectively erasing them. Who knew that snails have memories, right? Well, apparently they do, at least enough to influence their reactions to stimulus. When the discovery was made more than 5 years ago, it was not yet clear if the impact of inhibiting the PKM protein enzyme in humans could have the same impact as it apparently did in snails. But nevertheless, the results of the study were seen as a breakthrough and a promise of a kind of healing that might be possible through the intentional forgetting of our past. In studies since, evidence has surfaced that memories can be erased through drugs that block a chemical in the human body associated with our fight or flight response. In one experiment, people with a fear of spiders could, within a few days of taking the drug, handle the very spiders that would have sent them running away earlier in the week. It was as if the memory of their fear had been literally deleted by the drug, or at least reformed into something less threatening. Now, up to now, this is mostly the stuff of science fiction. I found no evidence that researchers have entirely erased a memory in humans, and yet, given advances in recent years, it seems possible that they could. It seems possible that someday soon, for example, people with post-traumatic stress disorder could choose to be relieved of their traumatic memories, at least enough to develop a new relationship with the experiences that once brought them debilitating pain. As someone who has not endured PTSD, I cannot point to memories that have been traumatic enough for me that I would definitely want to erase them. While I've had more than a few memories I might prefer to do without, memories of difficult conversations, memories of the unalterable suffering of those I love, and memories of bad choices and the embarrassing moments that have followed. I still cannot be sure that erasing those memories would be worth what I would lose if I had not experienced them. For through them, I have learned things about life that I might otherwise not have known, painful though those things may be. Still, I can imagine that, given certain circumstances, erasing memories would be tempting. I know of some stories that my friends carry with them, for example, that I'm not sure I could shoulder myself. My life in ministry has taught me that most of us go through life with at least some memories we would never choose and that we would never wish on other people. And so I offer this reflection today in what I hope will be received as a compassionate spirit. I acknowledge that none of us can assign for others the meaning in or potential value of any past event. We simply cannot demand that no matter what has happened, there is potential goodness or even inherent meaning for others in their painful experiences and memories. Still, I have come to believe in the possibility of meaning, the possibility of value, the possibility of a kind of healing, even in the bleakest of circumstances. You see, many of the people who have told me of their experiences of awful pain and loss, experiences they would never wish on anyone, experiences that I have trouble imagining living through myself, These people have also told me that they are grateful in hindsight for what these experiences eventually opened up for them, what these experiences revealed about their own resilience, how these experiences helped point them toward meaning that could still be found even when life seemed most meaningless. I've been particularly interested in finding meaning in the meaningless since my teens. When I watched my mother suffer for years with a debilitating depression that could keep her from even the most mundane of tasks. A depression that eventually led her, my junior year of college, to complete suicide. I have plenty of memories of her struggle that I might choose to forget were that possible. But I wouldn't choose to forget the meaning I found being a witness to her suffering. The meaning I wish she too could have found before it was too late. The spring of her death, I was enrolled in a course called Existential Literature. Awesome. One of the first texts we read was The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus. In this short book, Camus suggested that, given the absurdity of the human beings yearning for reason in an unreasonable world, the fundamental question of philosophy is judging whether life is or is not worth living. Camus rejected suicide as an option, preferring instead to confront the absurdity and ultimate meaninglessness of life by the revolt of choosing to live despite it all. At the time, I didn't find his perspective uplifting exactly, but I admired his honesty, especially when just a few weeks later, my mom took her own life. Her death offered me a powerful case study of the absurdity of life, and it left me with many painful memories to consider. The final week of this course, we were assigned to write an essay about an existential experience in our lives. Lucky me, I had just the topic to write about. Choosing to reflect in writing on what my family and I were living through when our lives were still so raw in so many ways turned out to be a blessing. It offered me an immediate opportunity to intentionally place the journey we had traveled together in a broader context. It gave me a sense of remove and perspective that helped me navigate memories I would certainly not want to relive, but that pointed me toward meaning nonetheless, the meaning that was evident in the responsibilities of my remaining relationships to my family, to my friends, even to my coursework. Several years later, I discovered the work of Viktor Frankl and found in his book Man's Search for Meaning a more hopeful existentialist take on how to live through suffering and painful memories other than just enduring for the sake of enduring. A 20th century Austrian-born Jewish psychiatrist, Frankl knew about suffering and painful loss firsthand. He spent 3 years in Nazi concentration camps, separated from his wife and his family, knowing that he would likely never see his loved ones again. He chose his own revolt. He decided that his time in the camp would offer him a testing ground to validate an approach to psychiatry he'd been crafting, an approach he called logotherapy. His time in the camps, amidst the suffering of those around him and his own challenges, confirmed for him his developing theory, which acknowledged that even when we cannot avoid suffering, we can choose how to cope with it, find meaning in it, move forward through it. He later reflected that his time in the camps revealed for him the ultimate human freedom, the freedom to take a stand to whatever conditions might confront us. He said, "How we react to the unchangeable conditions is up to us. If we cannot change a situation, We always have the last freedom to change our attitude to that situation. Frankl claimed that despair could be explained in a kind of mathematical equation. D equals S minus M. Despair equals suffering minus meaning. To Frankl, despair is suffering without meaning. When faced with suffering, he contended, if one can point oneself toward meaning, one's predicament can be molded into an accomplishment. Tragedy can be turned into triumph. Frankl thought there were three primary ways to make this meaning: doing or creating something, experiencing something or someone, or facing an unalterable situation that has caused suffering and squeezing out from the situation a potential meaning. At the heart of this meaning-making is the human freedom of choice, the ability to make a decision about how we will live, even in the worst conditions. Frankl found that in the camps, that those most likely to survive were those most oriented toward meaning in the future. He told the story of two of his fellow prisoners who confessed separately to him that they were close to choosing suicide, telling Frankl that they had nothing to expect from life anymore. Nothing to expect from life anymore. Frankl said he offered both of them a question in return. Is it possible, he asked, that life is expecting something from you? Is it possible that life is expecting something from you? In his question, he was asking his comrades to consider the meaning that could still be waiting for them as long as they remained alive. Now, I've wandered a bit from the questions I began with, the questions of whether or not you would choose to erase memories if you could, but I'm thinking I haven't wandered too far. Because at the heart of these questions and the stories of Camus and Frankl are the opportunities of choice. How do we choose to view life? What do we expect from it? What does life expect from us? Several years ago, I preached a sermon from this pulpit entitled The Burden of Choice, in which I contended that the gift and burden of Unitarian Universalism was that it enables us to choose how we're going to view life. We get to choose. The gift is the freedom to make the choice. The burden is the responsibility that accompanies the freedom to choose. Not long after I preached that sermon, one of the pillars of the congregation at the time, a woman just shy of her 80th birthday named Mary Ellen, told me that she wanted to have some words with me. She disagreed with my sermon, and she felt we needed to talk about it. So I paid her a visit, sharing a pot of tea in her sitting room as we discussed whether or not we humans do, in fact, reliably have choices. Mary Ellen had spent much of her adult life volunteering for Hospice of Central Iowa and in other social service settings where she could see up close how often people simply do not have the options that many of us take for granted. I also knew that she was no stranger to the dark days of depression herself, days when the only real choice it seems one has is whether or not to live, and often that choice seems predetermined by our own predispositions. As Parker Palmer, a writer and teacher who has had his own battles with depression, has put it, I understand why some depressed people kill themselves. They need the rest. I remember telling Mary Ellen that I understood that choices are easier to discern for some than for others, but that I still believed, no matter how difficult our lives get, we do, in fact, have choices in how we're going to interpret our lives and how we make sense of the senseless and how we endure yet another day toward the possibility, not the guarantee, but the possibility of a better tomorrow. I may have even mentioned Frankl's words to her. She tolerated my opinions, but didn't seem persuaded, which was fine by me. After all, I knew Mary Ellen well enough to know that she had no need to be converted to my way of thinking. Also, I was fully aware of the differences in what our eyes had seen and experienced in this life. So I was under no compulsion to have this wise friend of mine agree with my then 30-something perspective. Still, I thought a lot about that conversation with Mary Ellen the next couple of years, especially when I visited her in her hospital room her final October, not long after she'd been told that, despite her valiant efforts to fight it, the cancer had taken over too much of her body, and she only had a few weeks to live. As we talked, we shared some tears and even a few laughs, but mostly we just enjoyed each other's presence, acknowledging the reality that had always been true, but that was now painfully obvious like never before. We would, one day, sooner than later, have to say goodbye. And somehow that would have to be okay. I mean, we could choose to fight it, to wail against the finitude of this life, but that wouldn't change things. Any meaning we would make together would have to be made in the shadow of an inevitable emptiness that would follow. Over the next few weeks, when I visited with Mary Ellen, I brought words of comfort and appreciation from the congregation. I described things happening in the lives of people she knew. And near the end, when she was fading in and out of consciousness, we even sang a bit together. We sang Hymn of Valor, Spirit of Life. We didn't talk about choices anymore. It had become clear to me that we were both right. We had no choice but to accept what was happening to her, just as she had to accept all that had already happened in her life as she began to say her final goodbyes. But I did have a choice in how I would carry with me what I experienced in her presence, what her life taught me, who I might become as a result of having known her and learned from her. And my choice was to see it all as a blessing. My ability to make that choice had a lot to do with my own life and the expectations I have for it. And I suppose that's how it's going to be for all of us. I still believe that life is mostly absurd, except for the meaning we make with each other, through the times that we'll make for good memories and bad. Any healing that may come has less to do, I think, with forgetting the bad stuff that has happened and more to do with the attitude with which we face the absurdities and the possibilities of our always finite lives. Even in the midst of the desolation and spiritual impoverishment of a concentration camp, Viktor Frankl found that the human imagination and the memories and yearnings contained therein could be a place of refuge, inspiration, and meaning. As his inner life became more intense, his appreciation of beauty and life's blessings became more pronounced as well. He described a moment he shared with his camp comrades. He writes, "One evening, when we were already resting on the floor of our hut, dead tired, soup bowls in hand, a fellow prisoner rushed in and asked us to run out to the assembly grounds and see the wonderful sunset. Standing outside, we saw sinister clouds glowing in the west and colors from steel blue to blood red. The desolate gray mud huts provided a sharp contrast, while the puddles on the muddy ground reflected the glowing sky. Then, after minutes of moving silence, one prisoner said to another, 'How beautiful the world could be. How beautiful the world could be.'" It is the human imagination, an imagination inspired in its best moments by love and beauty, that can remain even when everything else may be stripped away. It is this yearning for how beautiful the world could be that can keep us going despite all the reasons not to. It is the human yearning for fulfillment and meaning that enables us to live through that which would otherwise hold us down, if not bury us alive. And it is the human need to love and to be loved, to which we so gratefully return, even after the most perilous journeys into darkness. Martha Shen is a member of this church. She's been an active leader for years in our Soul Matters program. Each meeting, she graces her groups and me with original poetry related to the month's theme. She has agreed to read a poem that she shared with us in this month of healing, a poem with the title, Expectation.
I have never expected life to be easy. I have expected my soul to grow, no matter what. I have been like the orchid you had to soak so long before the water would penetrate its parched roots. Patiently you waited day after day until finally it flowered for a full 6 months, declaring its glory beautifully. Life cannot be fixed, but it can be healed. I touched the scar and remembered to be thankful. I have walked through the desert. I have been the desert. I have dug down deep, blasting through the granite of the situation in search of water. My tears filling the well of my existence, brimming over the top, evaporating into the dry air, searing hot, the mist making rainbows in my eyes, until I behold the skies beautifully. Have you seen the desert after the rain? I have made up stories to grind down the mountains of your life into manageable walking paths. My own road is paved with the gravel of the experience. I have forgiven the rash acts, the unkind words, tenderly touched the turmoil of your life, remembering my own indomitable strife, fingering the bruise. When I look to be thankful, I am. When I look through the story, when I see with my heart, I expect compassion to emerge. Compassion heals us both. Now together we see the world differently. The shadows only shape the wonder into perspective. I have not expected life to be easy. Nothing beautiful ever is.
I have not expected life to be easy. Nothing beautiful ever is. Won't you join me in a spirit of prayer? Creative Spirit, healing power of human imagination, source of the inherent worth and resilience in us all, teach us to compassionately hold the stories of our lives. Help us to manage our memories of pain and loss toward reconciliation with our own dignity and possibility. Give us strength to learn from our weakness and to seek always a redemptive perspective on the absurdities of life and our own abilities to effect positive change for ourselves and thereby for others. We ask this in gratitude for the precious moments we still have to live, to learn, and to love. We ask this in gratitude for all that is our life. Amen.